A family. Those people ain't your family. They don't want to be, and you can't make them.
I'm not trying to.
Then why are you sniffing around that girl? You can't make nobody be what they don't want to be. And if your aunt wants to be a white woman, it's her life.
You don't understand, she said.
You're right,
he said, throwing up his hands.
I don't understand you at all.
That's not what I meant, she said. But wasn't it? He hadn't watched her mother spend years pining after Stella, or early driving thousands of miles searching for her. He didn't see the mornings Judith spent digging through the crates in the back of the closet, sifting through Stella's things. Junk mostly, a few old toys, or an earring or a sock. She couldn't tell if her grandmother chose to keep these mementos, or if she'd forgotten the boxes were even there. But she'd sort through them, trying to discover what made Stella different. How had she found a way to leave Mallard when her mother only knew how to stay? All November, she reported to Kennedy Sanders' dressing room to help lift the big dress over her head. Then each evening, she stood in the wing of the theater, searching the audience for Stella. She did not see her once. Still, she looked for her as the overture faded and Kennedy finally took the stage. Somehow, as soon as the show started, she lost that smart-alecky tone that made the crew roll their eyes. When the lights hit, she was no longer the sarcastic girl chain-smoking in the alley. She became Dolly, the sweet, carefree nobody lost in an abandoned town.
I don't know, she said. I've just always loved the stage. Everyone watching you. Sort of thrilling, isn't it?
After a Saturday night show, she'd offered to drive Jude home. She glanced across the car, smiling at her, and Jude, fidgeting, stared out the window. She hated how directly Kennedy looked at her, as if she were daring her to look away.
No, Jude said. I'd hate everyone staring at me like that.
Why?
I don't know. It makes me feel exposed, I guess.
Kennedy laughed.
Yes, but acting is different, she said. You only show people what you want to.
Chapter 13. By December, the Midnight Marauders poster outside the Stardust Theater had already been tacked over with an advertisement for West Side Story. Jude must have looked so glum that the man changing the marquee glanced down his ladder and said,
"Sometimes they bring him back for a second run."
But she wasn't thinking about the show. She was only thinking about Stella, who still had not appeared. Now the play was over, and what did she even have to show for it? A few old stories about a woman she would never know. On the night of the final performance, she stepped into the empty theater to sweep the floors and found Kennedy standing alone on the dim stage. She was never early, so Jude asked if something was wrong. Kennedy laughed.
"I always come early to the last show," she said. "It's the one people will remember you by, you know? You're only as good as your last performance."
She was wearing ripped jeans and a big floppy purple hat that hid half her face. She always dressed like that, like a child ripping clothes out of a costume chest.
"Why don't you come on up?"
Kennedy said. Jude laughed, glancing around the empty theater.
"What are you talking about?" she said. "I'm working."
"So? No one's here. Just come up for a second, just for fun. I bet you've never been on a stage like this before."
She hadn't, although she'd thought about trying out for the school play every year. Her mother had starred in Romeo and Juliet, learned all that funny English, had to let Ike Godot kiss her in front of the whole school. But what a time she'd had, taking her final bow to thunderous applause. Her mother would have been thrilled to see Jude star in anything. And she'd almost found the nerve to audition, not because she wanted the role, but because acting was something her mother once loved. She wanted to prove to herself that they were alike, but she'd barely stepped into the theater for tryouts before she imagined the whole town laughing at her, and she slipped out the wing before the drama teacher called her name. She propped her broom against the front row seats.
"I almost tried out for a play once," she told Kennedy, climbing the steps, "but I chickened out."
"Well, maybe that's your problem," Kennedy said. "You tell yourself no before anyone even says it to you."
The theater did look different from the stage. The house lights dimmed, so you couldn't see the faces of all the people watching you. How strange that must be, to not know what the people looking at you were thinking.
"I used to have these terrible nightmares," Kennedy said, "when I was little. I mean, awful ones."
"About what?"
"That's the thing, I could never remember. But when I started acting, they stopped. It was the strangest thing. Like, there was something bad inside me trying to get out, and I could only get rid of it here."
She tapped the stage floor.
"But that doesn't make any sense, does it? The doctors said that creative people have the most vivid dreams. I don't know why. Maybe you'll figure it out when you're a doctor."
She didn't want to be a psychologist, but she was grateful for Kennedy's confidence. "When you're a doctor." It sounded so easy when she said it.
"Yes," she said, "maybe."
She followed her down off the stage. She could hear the rest of the company arriving, giddy as they raced around backstage, dressing for the final time. She would sweep the theater floor and take her place in the dark one last time. And after the final curtain, for the first time since she'd realized who Kennedy Sanders was, she had no idea when she might see her again.
"You should come to the cast party," Kennedy said. "Bring your boyfriend. I bet the theater will pay him to take some pictures."
The suggestion was surprisingly thoughtful. She'd told Kennedy once that Reese was a photographer, but she never expected her to remember.
"Thanks," she said. "I'll give him a call."
Kennedy started toward backstage, then paused.
"I don't know what happens after this."
"What do you mean?" Maybe, to an actor, the dark wing of a theater felt as intimate as church. Either way, Kennedy began to confess. She didn't know what she would do tomorrow. No, literally, what she would do when she woke up in the morning, because this play was the only thing that had given her any sense of purpose in months. It was the only thing she was good at, acting. She'd left school because she was shit at it. She was shit at everything else. And maybe her mother was right. Maybe she had made a big mistake. Maybe acting was a waste of time. Maybe her parents argued so much because they were splitting up. Maybe her mother would rather grade math assignments than talk to her. Maybe all those things were true. And maybe she had only landed her biggest role yet because the boy she was sleeping with told her one night, while they were stoned, that his big brother had written a hilariously bad play that some company was putting on downtown. And even though it was bad, she'd wept when she read the script. A lonely girl living in a world surrounded only by ghosts. Nothing reminded her of her own life more. Maybe the director, Doug, sensed this, or maybe he just liked looking at her tits, or maybe the boy told his brother to pull some strings, to do whatever he had to do to make sure that her name was at the top of the call sheet. Either way, she won the starring role.
"But I could never tell my mother any of this," she said. "She'd just say that she was right. She cares more about being right than being my mother. Sometimes I don't even think she likes me very much."
"Isn't that something? To think your own mother can't even stand you?" She was smiling, but her violet eyes filled with tears.
"I'm sure that's not true," Jude said.
"Well, you don't know her, do you?" Kennedy said. That night, for the final time, she witnessed Kennedy Sanders transform under the spotlight.
Kennedy strutting out for the opening number in the town square, singing her contemplative solo in the cemetery. High kicking on the bar during the act-closing dance with a chorus of drunk ghosts. On stage, you couldn't tell the girl had just been crying. She became new each time she stepped under the lights. After the first act ended, applause ringing in the theater, Jude waded through the crowd to the concession stand. She was shoveling lukewarm popcorn into a paper bag when she saw, finally, Stella. Her mother, but not. That's the only way she could think of her, like her mother's face transplanted onto another woman's body. Stella wore a long green dress, her hair pulled into a low bun. Diamond earrings, black pumps. She was fiddling with a leather pocketbook as she glided through the lobby, rolling her neck a little before she smiled at a tall man holding open the door. For a second, in that smile, she was Mama. Then the mask slid back on, another woman taking over. There was no time to think. Jude abandoned the popcorn station and followed, pushing through the crowded lobby to the door. Outside, she found Stella standing under the eaves, fumbling for a cigarette. She glanced over, startled by the sudden intrusion, and Jude froze. Her first stupid thought was that Stella might recognize her. She'd see something familiar in her face, her eyes, or her mouth even, and then she would gape, her pocketbook falling open on the sidewalk. But Stella's eyes glazed over, and she stared moodily into the street. Jude alone with the pounding heart. "Hi," Jude said. "I'm friends with your daughter." She couldn't think of anything else to say. Stella paused, then lit her cigarette. "From school," she said. Her voice was smoother, softer.
"No, from the play."
"Oh,
lovely,"
Stella said. It was a word her mother would have never used, lovely. Stella gave a little smile, then she took a drag, glancing up at the eve.
"Did you want a cigarette?" she asked.
Jude almost said yes. At least then she'd have a reason to be standing there.
"No," she said, "I don't smoke."
"Good girl," Stella said.
"They say it's awful for your health."
"I know, my mother's trying to quit." Stella glanced at her.
"It's terribly difficult to quit," she said. "All the best things are."
Intermission was nearly over. Soon Stella would head back inside, disappearing into the darkness of the theater. When the play ended, she would join the crowd surging out onto the street. She would go home, and maybe later that night, in a quiet moment, she would think about that dark girl who'd interrupted her smoke break, and then she'd never remember the moment again.
"Kennedy said you're from Louisiana," Jude finally said.
"I am too. I'm from Mallet."
Stella glanced at her, an eyebrow slightly arched. Nothing in her body changed. Nothing suggested that she'd even heard, except for that tiny lift of her eyebrow.
"All right," she said. "I'm sorry, I don't know it. My mama,"
Jude took a breath.
"My mama's name is Desiree Veans."
Now Stella turned toward her.
"Who the hell are you?"
she said quietly.
"I told you, my mama."
"Who are you?
What are you doing here? I don't understand."
She was partly smiling, but she held the cigarette away from her body, warning Jude not to come closer. She was angry. Jude hadn't expected that. Stella would be confused, startled even. But maybe once the surprise wore off, she thought, Stella might be glad to meet her. She might even marvel at all the works of chance that had drawn them together. Instead, Stella shook her head, as if trying to wake herself from a nightmare.
"I wanted to meet you," Jude said.
"No, no, no. I don't understand. Who are you, really?
You look nothing like her."
Through the window, the lobby lights flickered.
She was supposed to be guiding people back to their seats. Her supervisor was probably going crazy looking for her. And what would he find if he stepped outside right now? A black girl pleading for a white woman to recognize her.
"She told me how you used to hide in the bathroom," Jude said. "At that laundry place in New Orleans. She said you almost cut your hand off."
She was rambling now, willing to say anything to keep Stella from leaving. Stella took a shaky drag, then stomped out her cigarette on the sidewalk. She would never go back to Mallet, she said.
"Well, we had to get away from my daddy. He kept beating on her."
"Beating on her?" Stella paused, softening. "I mean, is she still?
Is my mama still?" "They're still down there. My mama works at the diner."
"Luz? My God, I haven't thought about Luz in..." Stella stopped. "Well, it must have been awful for you." Jude glanced away. She hated the thought of Stella pitying her.
"My mama kept looking for you," she said.
Stella's mouth curved, like she was going to smile or cry, her face somehow caught in between, like a sun shower. The devil beating his wife, her mother used to say, and Jude imagined it every time she heard her father rage. The devil could love the woman he beat. The sun could burst through a rainstorm. Nothing was as simple as you wanted it to be. Without thinking, she reached toward her aunt, but Stella jutted her arm out. Her eyes were shining.
"She shouldn't have," Stella said. "She should have forgotten all about me." "But she didn't. You can call her. We can call her right now. She would be so glad."
"I've got to go," Stella said.
"But it's too much," she said. "I can't go back through that door. It's another life, you understand?"
Headlights washed over them, and for a second, bathed in yellow light, Stella looked panicked, as if she might run into the car's path. Then she clutched her purse tightly and disappeared into the night. At the cast party, all of the actors and musicians gathered around to watch their show lead get hammered and complain to anyone who might listen that her mother hadn't shown.
"Can you believe it?" she kept saying. "Closing night, and all she gave me is that she would try. Not too hard, apparently."
No one had ever seen her in such a nasty mood. She'd barely lingered on stage past the curtain call, ignored the cast members who tried to congratulate her, dumped the roses the director had given her into the trash. She hadn't even offered to sign playbills at the stage door. Now she was spending the first half hour of the cast party pounding tequila alone at the bar.
"My first big show," she told Jude. "All she had to do was sit through it, and she couldn't even do that."
Across the bar, Reese was roving, snapping candid photos of the cast. She should have been happy for him, behind the camera again, but instead she was standing at the bar, beside a surly, drunk girl, still shaken. She'd met Stella, but Stella didn't want to know her. It shouldn't have been surprising. She hadn't wanted anything to do with the family for decades, so nothing had changed. But why did Jude feel as if she'd lost someone? Again, she saw herself reaching towards Stella, Stella pushing her away. She felt as if she'd reached for her mother and only felt her shove her back.
"I have to go," she said.
She felt too hot in that crowded party, desperate for air.
"What are you talking about?" Kennedy said. "The party just started."
"I know. I'm sorry, I can't stay."
"Come on," she said.
"Just have a drink with me, please."
She sounded so vulnerable, Jude nearly said yes, almost. But she imagined Stella disappearing into the night, glancing over her shoulder, panicked, as if she were being hunted. And she shook her head. I really can't, she said. My boyfriend's ready to go.
Across the room, Reese was packing up his camera and chatting with Barry. Kennedy glanced over, watching the two for a second.
You're really lucky, you know, she said. She was still smiling, but meanness wedged inside her voice.
What do you mean? Jude said.
Nothing. But you know, nobody really expects someone like him to be with you, do they?
Kennedy laughed.
You know, I don't mean anything by it. I'm just saying. Your men usually like the light girls, don't they?
Years later, she would always wonder what exactly pushed her. That sly smile, or the way she'd said your men so casually, as if it didn't include her. Or maybe it was because Kennedy was right. She knew how lucky Jude felt to be loved. She knew, even though Jude tried to hide it, exactly how to hurt her. For weeks, she'd followed Kennedy around the Stardust Theater. She'd helped her dress, brought her tea, listened to her trill notes in the hallway. She'd cleaned toilets to talk to her, wondering always how this strange girl could be related to her. But she finally saw it. Kennedy Sanders was nothing but an uppity Mallard girl who believed the fiction she'd been told. You're so stupid, Jude said. You don't even know what you are.
And what's that?
Your mother's from Mallard. Where mine's from. They're twins. They look exactly alike, and even you would see it, Kennedy laughed.
You're crazy.
No, your mother's crazy. She's been lying to you your whole life. She regretted the words as soon as they left her mouth. But by then it was too late. She had rung the bell, and all her life, the note would hang in the air.
Mr. Park brought bulgogi on the house, setting the dish on the table.
So sad, he said. Never seen you so sad.
What a sight they must have been. Jude dabbing at her puffy eyes, Reese somber beside her, looking as helpless as he always did whenever she cried. He squeezed her shoulder and said,
Come on, baby, eat.
But she wasn't hungry. On the ride over, she told him about the whole terrible night. She told him everything except what Kennedy had said to hurt her, because it cut too close to share, even with him.
You were right, she said. You were right about everything. I should have never gone looking.
It's okay, he said. You wanted to know them. Now you do. Now you can move on.
I can't tell Mama, she said.
She'd never kept a secret like this from her mother before. But if it was cruel to not tell her that Stella was alive, that she'd met her even, then wasn't it even worse to tell her that Stella wanted nothing to do with her? What good would come of her mother discovering that the sister she'd spent years searching for wouldn't even call her? Maybe her mother would realize that losing her was for the best. Maybe over time, she would just forget Stella, the way Jude had already started to lose her father's face. Not all at once, but slowly, her memories disintegrating. Eventually, remembering turned into imagining. How slight the difference was between the two. Her mother would never forget Stella. She would stare into the mirror for the rest of her life, reminded of her loss. But Jude wouldn't add to her grief. She would talk to her mother on the phone, days later, and not say a word about Stella. Maybe she was like her aunt in that way. Maybe, like Stella, she became a new person in each place she'd lived, and she was already unrecognizable to her mother, a girl who hoarded secrets, a liar. The morning after the play, Stella awoke with a pounding heart. She'd barely opened her eyes before the previous night returned to her. That awful play she'd finally attended, even though she knew acting was a waste of her daughter's time and talents. But she'd gone because it was closing night. She'd sat through the dreadful thing,
delighted and a little surprised that her daughter was the only bright spot. At intermission, she'd applauded as loudly as anyone, hoping her daughter would see her. But the girl ducked backstage with the rest of the cast, and Stella slipped out for a smoke. She was thinking, leaving the dingy theater, about how she could make things right. She could take Kennedy to dinner after the show, apologize for not attending sooner, suggest that she take more drama classes as long as she went back to school. And that was when that dark girl had emerged from the shadows. After, Stella charged into the street, not even thinking about where she was going. She'd stumbled 2 blocks downtown before remembering where she'd parked. The dark girl couldn't be Desiree's daughter. She looked nothing like her, pure black, like Desiree had never even touched her. She could be anyone. But how then had she known those stories about New Orleans? Who else would know but Desiree? Well, maybe she told someone. Maybe this girl thought she could come to California and threaten to expose Stella. Blackmail her, even. The possibilities grew more lurid in her head, none of them making sense. How had the girl even found her? And if she'd wanted to blackmail her, why hadn't she named her price instead of withering on the sidewalk as if her feelings were hurt, as if Stella had disappointed her somehow?
"Your heart's racing," Blake said.
He lifted his head, smiling sleepily at her. He liked to fall asleep with his head on her breasts, and she let him because it was sweet.
"I had a strange dream," she said.
"A scary one?"
She ran her fingers through his graying blonde hair.
"I used to have these nightmares," she said, "that these men would drag me out of bed. It felt so real. I could feel their hands on my ankles even after I woke up."
"That's not why you keep that bat here, is it?"
She started to respond, but instead turned away, her eyes filling with tears.
"Something happened," she said, "when I was young."
"What happened?"
"I saw something."
But her voice cracked, and she couldn't say any more. Blake kissed her cheek.
"Oh, honey, don't cry," he said softly. "I don't know what you're so afraid of. I'll always keep you safe."
She kissed him before he could say anything else. They made love desperately, the way they had when she was 19, touching Mr. Sanders for the first time. The image would have made her younger self blush. Two middle-aged people gripping each other's bodies, knocking off the covers as sunlight cracked through the blinds, the alarm clock blaring, calling each to a separate day. Her body changed, his body changing, familiar and foreign at the same time. When you married someone, you promised to love every person he would be. He promised to love every person she had been. And here they were, still trying, even though the past and the future were both mysteries. That morning, she was late for class. A quick shower, then she was pulling a blouse onto her damp shoulders, Blake smiling at her through the mirror as he shaved.
"I do believe I made you late to work, Mrs. Sanders," he said, which didn't have as nice a ring to it as Dr. Sanders. But maybe that was okay. Maybe it was enough to be Mrs. Sanders. Maybe it was enough to have her introduction to statistics class, and her house, and her family. That dark girl. She saw her again, tried to shake her out of her mind. She'd been arrogant, that was her problem.
So focused on what was next that she didn't appreciate what she'd already gotten away with. She couldn't let herself slip up like that again. She'd have to focus, stay alert. She was running out the door when she bumped into her daughter, lugging a bag of laundry up the steps. Both women jolted. Then Kennedy flashed the disarming smile she'd inherited from her father. It was impossible to ever be angry at that smile. And Kennedy had tested it often, when she'd begged for a puppy but left Yolanda to care for him, when she'd failed ninth grade geometry in spite of Stella's attempts to help her, when she'd crashed her first Camaro and somehow convinced Blake to buy her a second one.
"Well, she's gotta have a way to get around," he said,
and Stella, tired of being the difficult one, finally agreed. Not that she'd had much to say. Kennedy learned long ago that if she wanted anything, she ought to ask her father. Telling Stella was a mere formality.
"I was hoping to speak to you," Stella said. "Listen, about last night."
I know, you're sorry. But if you weren't going to come, you could have just told me. I would have given the ticket to someone else."
"I did see your play. I just had to slip out early, that's all. I wasn't feeling well. Something I ate, probably. But I promise I was there. I thought it was very clever. The ghosts and all. And that song you did in the saloon, I loved it all, really."
Her daughter was wearing big, shiny sunglasses, so Stella couldn't see her eyes, only her own face reflected back at her. She looked calm, natural. Not like a woman who had awakened with her heart racing. "Did you really like it?" Kennedy asked.
"Of course, darling. I thought you were marvelous."
She pulled her daughter into a hug, running a hand along her thin shoulder blades.
"All right," she said. "I'm running late. Have a good day."
She fumbled with her attaché case, searching for her keys, when she heard her daughter call over her shoulder. "You've never been to a place called Mallard, have you?" Stella never expected to hear that word fall out of her daughter's mouth. And for the first time all morning, she faltered.
"What do you mean?" she said.
"I met this girl from there. She said she knows you."
"I've never even heard of the place. Mallard, did you say?"
That disarming smile again. Kennedy shrugged. "That's okay," she said. "Maybe she was thinking of someone else." When Blake came home from work that evening, Stella told him about the dark girl. All afternoon, she debated whether to say anything before deciding that she should. A preemptive strike. She didn't want him to think that she had anything to hide, and she preferred him to hear the story from her. She hated the idea of her husband and daughter whispering about her. So while he undressed for bed, she told him that a dark girl, claiming to be a cousin, had cornered Kennedy after her play. She watched his face the entire time, waiting to see it change. A flicker of recognition, maybe. Relief that a question he'd always wondered had finally been answered. But he just scoffed, unbuttoning his dress shirt. "It's the Camaro," he said. "I'm sure she saw it and thought, boom, payday."
"Exactly," Stella said. "That's exactly right. That's what I've been trying to tell her."
"This city, I swear, sometimes."
They'd been talking recently about leaving Los Angeles, moving to Orange County, maybe, or even farther north to Santa Barbara. She'd resisted at first, not wanting to leave her job, but now she kept imagining that dark girl creeping up to her again, poking her head in doorways, tapping on the windows. Or worse, the girl following Kennedy around the city, appearing at her shows, stalking her between auditions. What could she possibly want? Again, her face flashed through Stella's mind, how she'd stood under that eave, wounded. Stella's mistake had been to think that she could settle anywhere. You had to keep moving, or the past would always catch up to you.
"You know those people downtown," she said. "High out their minds, half of them."
"Hell, more than half," Blake said, sliding in bed beside her.
The first time she'd ever been white, Stella couldn't wait to tell Desiree what she'd done. Desiree would never believe it. She didn't think Stella was capable of doing anything surprising. But that evening, when Stella returned home, she passed her sister in the hallway and said nothing. A secret transgression was even more thrilling than a shared one. She had shared everything with Desiree. She wanted something of her own. She was 44 now. She'd spent more of her life without Desiree than with her. Still, as the weeks passed, she felt Desiree's pull on her tighten, like a hand gripping her neck. Sometimes it felt like a gentle rub, other times it choked her. She blamed the dark girl, although she hadn't seen her since that night outside the Stardust Theater. The city was large. The girl would never find her again. Stella never thought of her as a niece. Niece didn't seem the right word for a girl you didn't know, a girl who looked nothing like you. Then again, wouldn't Desiree feel the same way about Kennedy? Sometimes even Stella stared at her daughter and saw a stranger. It wasn't Kennedy's fault that Stella had decided long ago to become someone else. Now her whole life had been built on that lie, and the other lies Stella stacked in order to maintain it, until one dark girl appeared, threatening to send them all tumbling down.
"Did you ever have a sister?"
Kennedy asked one night. Stella, bending over to sweep crumbs off the table, stiffened.
"What do you mean?" she said. "You know I didn't. I just thought, you're not still thinking about that black girl, are you?"
But her daughter bit her lip, staring out the darkened window. She was. She just hadn't said anything about it, which felt like an even bigger betrayal.
"My God," Stella said. "Who do you believe? Some crazy girl or your own mother?"
"But why would she lie? Why would she say those things to me? She wants money. Or maybe she just wants to poke fun at you. Who knows why crazy people do things?"
Blake wandered into the kitchen, pausing, like he always did before stepping into one of their arguments, as if to remind himself that it wasn't too late to disengage and pretend this had nothing to do with him. He hadn't been interested enough in the dark girl to say much else about it, except that if Kennedy saw her again, she ought to call the police. Now he squeezed his daughter's shoulder.
"Just drop it, Ken," he said. "You can't let that girl get to you."
"I know, but..."
"We love you," he said. "We wouldn't lie to you."
But sometimes lying was an act of love. Stella had spent too long lying to tell the truth now. Or maybe there was nothing left to reveal. Maybe this was who she had become. In June, Stella and Blake surprised their daughter with the keys to a new apartment in Venice. They'd pay the rent for 1 year while she went on auditions, and after, she'd have to go back to school or find a job. Technically, it wasn't a bribe, but when Stella handed her ecstatic daughter the keys, she felt so awash in relief that it seemed like one. Maybe now her daughter would stop barraging her with questions about her past. She'd always worried about Kennedy discovering her secret and rejecting her, Blake leaving, her whole life disintegrating in her hands. What she hadn't pictured was doubt. It would almost have been better if Kennedy just believed that dark girl. Instead, she seemed to mull over her claims, sometimes considering them, sometimes rejecting them, and Stella never knew where she would land. She couldn't predict what she might ask or what she believed, and the uncertainty made her crazy. The new apartment would at least be a distraction, maybe even a solution. On a Saturday morning, she and Blake helped their daughter move in. Blake assembled furniture in the bedroom, and Stella wiped down the kitchen drawers, remembering the apartment she and Desiree had shared in New Orleans. The walls were paper thin, the floorboards always creaking, a water splotch growing across the ceiling. And yet, in spite of that, she'd loved that place. She'd been so grateful to leave Farrah Thibodeau's floor that she hadn't even cared how tiny and cramped this new apartment was. It was hers and it was Desiree's, and she'd felt as if they were both on the cusp of lives too big to even imagine. She teared up, and Kennedy startled her, hugging her from behind.
"Don't get all sappy," she said. "I'll still come by for dinner."
Stella laughed, dabbing her eyes.
"I hope you like this place," she said. "It's a nice little apartment. You should have seen mine in New Orleans."
"What was it like?"
"Well, it could have fit in here twice over. We were always on top of each other."
"Who was?"
Stella paused.
"I'm sorry?"
"You said we."
"Oh, right. My roommate. This girl I lived with. She was from my town."
"You never told me that before," Kennedy said. "You never tell me anything about your life."
"Kennedy,
it's not about that," she said. "It's not about that girl at all. It's just like, it's impossible to know anything about you. I have to beg you just to tell me about some roommate you had, and you're my mother. Why don't you want me to know you?"
She'd imagined, more than once, telling her daughter the truth about Mallard and Desiree and New Orleans, how she'd pretended to be someone else because she needed a job, and after a while, pretending became reality. She could tell the truth, she thought, but there was no single truth anymore. She'd lived a life split between two women, each real, each a lie.
"I've just always been this way," Stella said. "I'm not like you. Open. It's a good way to be. I hope you stay that way."
She handed her daughter a sheet of shelf paper, and Kennedy smiled.
"I don't know any other way to be," she said. "What do I have to hide?"
Part 5. Pacific Cove, 1985-1988. Chapter 14. In 1988, exhausted from her pursuit of artistic seriousness, and more importantly, pushing 30, Kennedy Sanders would begin to appear on a series of daytime soap operas, and a month after she turned 27, she would finally land a 3-season arc on Pacific Cove. It would be her longest acting job ever, and even decades later, she would sometimes be stopped in the mall by some gooey-eyed fan who called her Charity Harris. It was the role she was born to play, the director told her. She just had a face for the soaps. She must have frowned because he laughed, touching her arm way too close to her tits.
"It's not a knock, babe," he said. "I just mean, well, I can tell you have a flair for the dramatic."
There was nothing wrong with melodrama, she told her parents when she'd called to share the news. In fact, some of the greatest classic actresses, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Greta Garbo, trafficked in it from time to time. Her father was glad that she was moving back to California. Her mother was glad that she was working. After she hung up, she wandered around a Burbank shopping mall where, a year later, she would be stopped by a middle-aged woman outside a shoe rack and asked for an autograph. She was jolted each time someone approached her in public. They recognized her? Just as she was, before costumes, before hair and makeup? At first, she was thrilled. Then it unsettled her, the idea of anyone noticing her before she noticed them. An incomplete list of characters she played in the soap world before landing Pacific Cove. A conniving candy striper who steals a baby. A teacher who seduces her student's father. A stewardess who spills water on the lead, maybe accidentally, maybe intentionally. The script was unclear. The mayor's daughter who gets seduced by the show rogue. A nurse who gets strangled in a car. A florist who hands the star a rose. A stewardess who survives a plane crash to later be strangled in a car. She wore black wigs, brown wigs, red wigs, and eventually, when she played Charity Harris, her own blonde waves. She only played white girls, which is to say, she never played herself. On the set of Pacific Cove, the cast and crew referred to her as Charity, never her real name, and later, in an interview with Soap Digest, she would tell a reporter that it helped her stay in character. She preferred readers to think that she was a method actor than know the truth, that no one had bothered to learn her real name because they did not expect her to stick around. 3 seasons in the soap world was like 3 seconds anyway, and when the show ended in 1994, Charity Harris would appear in the finale for a millisecond as the camera swept over photographs on the wall. Only the most passionate fans would remember her most prominent arc, the 9 months she'd been kidnapped by her lover's stalker and tied up in a basement. For months, she'd twisted in the chair, screaming, pleading, begging, and not until years later would she realize that her biggest storyline was not being a real part of the show. She brought her mother to set once. She'd warned her beforehand that the soundstage could get chilly. So, ridiculously, her mother had worn a bright blue sweater in spite of the 90-degree heat in Burbank. Kennedy gave her a little tour around the sets, pointing out the exterior of the Harris house, the town hall, the surf shack where Charity worked. She even brought her to the basement where Charity was currently trapped, only 3 months into her abduction.
"I sure hope they let you out of there soon," her mother said, collapsing Kennedy and Charity like the rest of the crew. It was the most her mother had ever validated her as an actor.
Strange that the greatest compliment an actress could receive was that she had disappeared into somebody else. Acting is not about being seen, a drama teacher told her once. True acting meant becoming invisible so that only the character shone through.
"You should just change your name to Charity,"
the Pacific Cove director told her.
"No offense, but when I hear your name, I just think about a guy getting shot in the head."
Here's something she hadn't thought about in forever. Once, when she was 7 or so, she was sitting in the kitchen on a step stool, watching her mother frost a cake. She was wedged in a corner, trying to learn a new yo-yo trick so half-heartedly that she was just flinging the toy, sending it clattering to the tile, waiting for her annoyed mother to tell her to stop. She did things like that often, desperate things, too small to get her in trouble, but irritating enough to earn attention. But her mother wasn't even looking at her. She wasn't the type to transform a chore into a bonding opportunity. "Honey, let me show you how to knead bread," or "come here, baby, this is how you make frosting." Her mother seemed relieved once Kennedy aged out of asking to help in the kitchen.
"It's not that I don't want your help," her mother always said, "but I can do it faster on my own."
As if that last part contradicted the first one, not justified it. Why was she baking a cake in the first place? She wasn't the type to bake for no reason. She contributed store-bought cookies to bake sales, transferring them into a tin so nobody would notice. Her father's birthday, maybe. But it was summer, not spring, or else she wouldn't have been home from school in the middle of the day, bored, watching her mother smooth the tiny ripples of frosting.
"How'd you learn to do that?" she asked.
Her mother, concentrating hard, like she was restoring a damaged oil painting.
"I don't know," she finally said. "Picked it up over time."
"Did your mom show you?"
She thought her mother might say yes, call her over and hand her a knife, but she didn't even look up.
"We didn't have money for cakes," she said.
Later, Kennedy would realize how often her mother used money to avoid discussing her past, as if poverty were so unthinkable to Kennedy that it could explain everything. Why her mother owned no family photographs, why no friends from high school ever called, why they'd never been invited to a single wedding or funeral or reunion.
"We were poor,"
her mother would snap if she asked too many questions, that poverty spreading to every aspect of her life, her whole past, a barren pantry shelf.
"What was she like?"
Kennedy asked.
"Grandma?"
Her mother still didn't turn around, but her shoulders tightened.
It's strange to think of her like that, she said.
Like what?
A grandmother.
Well, she is. Even if you're dead, you're still somebody's grandma.
I suppose so, her mother said. Kennedy should have dropped it there, but she was angry. Her mother so focused on that damn cake, as if it were the important thing, as if talking to her daughter was the dreaded chore. She wanted her mother to stop what she was doing, to notice her.
Where did she die? She said.
Now her mother turned around. She was wearing a peach apron, her hands speckled with vanilla frosting, and she was frowning, not angry exactly, but confused.
What type of question is that? She said.
I'm just asking. You never tell me anything.
In Opelousas, Kennedy, she said. The same place I grew up. She never left and never went anywhere. Now, don't you have something else you could be doing right now?
Kennedy almost cried. She cried easily and often back then, embarrassing her mother, who only cried during the occasional sad movie, always laughing at herself after, apologizing as she swept tears from the corners of her eyes. Kennedy cried on the supermarket floor if she wanted a pink bouncy ball that her mother, dragging her down the aisle, refused to buy. On the playground, when she lost at tetherball. At night, when she woke from nightmares she couldn't remember. And she blinked back tears then, even as her mother said something that she knew was wrong.
That's not where you're from, she said.
What are you talking about? Of course it is.
No, it's not. You told me you were from a little town. It starts with an M. M something. You told me when I was little.
Her mother was quiet for so long that Kennedy started to feel crazy, like Dorothy at the end of The Wizard of Oz.
And you were there? And you were there too?
But the story about the town was real. She just couldn't remember all the particulars, except that she'd been in the bathtub, her mother leaning over her. But now her mother only laughed.
And when was I supposed to have told you this? She said. You're little now.
I don't know.
You must have remembered wrong. You were still a baby.
Her mother stepped forward, the cake behind her smoothed on the top and edges.
Come here, honey. Want to lick the spoon?
This was the first time Kennedy realized that her mother was a liar. The town clung. She couldn't shake it, even though she didn't remember its name, because she didn't remember its name, even. For years, she never mentioned it to her mother again. But one night in college, a little high, she'd pulled an encyclopedia off her boyfriend's shelf.
What are you doing?
He asked half-heartedly, more interested in the joint he was rolling, so she ignored him, flipping until she landed on Louisiana. Down, down the page to the list of cities and towns in alphabetical order. Mansfield, Marion, Marksville.
Hey, he said, put that shit down. You're not supposed to be fucking studying right now.
Mare Rouge, Milton, Monroe.
Come on, man. That book can't be more interesting than me.
Moonshine, Moss Bluff, Mount Lebanon. She would know its name when she saw it, she was sure. But she scanned the whole list, and not one of them seemed familiar. She slid the book back on the shelf.
Sorry, she said. I don't know what came over me.
After that night, she never tried to search for the town again. It would be something that she would always know she was right about, but could never prove. Like people who swore they'd seen Elvis wandering around the grocery store, knocking on the melons. Unlike those loons, she wouldn't tell anyone. A private crazy. She was okay with that. Until she met Jude Winston. That night, at the cast party, Jute spoke the word mallard, and it sounded like a song Kennedy hadn't heard in years. Ah, that's how it goes. In 1985, nearly 3 years after the Midnight Marauders closed, she saw Jude again in New York. She was still new to the city then, half surviving her first winter. All her life, she'd never imagined living outside of Los Angeles, but the city had started to feel smaller by the second. She hadn't seen Jude since the cast party, but she imagined bumping into her whenever she turned a corner. She saw her sitting in the windows of restaurants. Once, she'd flubbed her lines in Fiddler on the Roof because she'd spotted Jude in the front row. The woman looked just like her, dark, leggy, a little insecure, a little self-possessed. But by the time she realized her mistake, she'd ruined the whole scene. The director ordered the stagehands to remove her things from the dressing room before curtain. She blamed Jude. She blamed her for it all.
"I don't understand it," her mother said when she announced that she was moving to New York. "Why are you going all the way out there? You can become an actor right here."
But she wanted some space from her mother, too. At first, her mother refused to engage with Jude's claims. Then she tried reason. Do I look like a Negro? Do you? Does it make any sense that we could be related to her? No, it didn't. But little about her mother's life made sense. Where had she come from? What was her life like before she'd gotten married? Who had she been? Who had she loved? What had she wanted? The gaps. When she looked at her mother now, she only saw the gaps. And Jude, at least, had offered her a bridge, a way to understand. Of course, she couldn't stop thinking about her.
"I really wish you'd stop worrying about that," her mother told her. "You drive yourself crazy. In fact, I'm sure that's why she said all those things to you. She's jealous and wants to get in your head."
She'd answered Kennedy's questions, irritated but never angry. Then again, her mother was normally calm and rational. If she were to lie to her, she would do so as calmly and rationally as she did anything else. In New York, Kennedy lived in a basement apartment in Crown Heights with her boyfriend, France, who taught physics at Columbia. He was born in Port-de-Paix, but raised in Bed-Stuy in one of those red-brown project buildings she passed by on the bus. He liked to tell her horror stories about growing up, rats gnawing on his toes, cockroaches gathered in a corner of the closet, the dope boys who lingered in the building lobby, waiting to steal his sneakers. He wanted her to understand him, she thought at first, but later she realized that he just liked having a dramatic backstory that contrasted with the man he'd grown up to be. Careful, studious, always cleaning his horn-rimmed glasses. He wasn't cool. She liked that. He wasn't one of the black boys she'd admired from afar. Smooth boys, slouched in beat-up cars, or gathered in front of the movie theater, whistling at girls walking by. She and her friends pretended to be annoyed, but secretly delighted in the attention from these boys they could never kiss, boys who could never call home. Oh, the little crushes she had on these boys. Safe ones, the way Jim Kelly sent a thrill through her. She'd perch on the arm of her father's chair during Lakers games, just for a glimpse of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in those goggles. Harmless crushes, really, but she knew better than to tell anybody about them. France was her first black lover. She was his fourth white one.
Fourth? She said. Really? What were the other three like?
He laughed. They were standing in his faculty advisor's kitchen during a department party, drinking ginger beers. They'd just started dating then, and she was overdressed. She'd worn a long skirt and heels, imagining herself in some glamorous 1960s movie, hanging on the arm of her bespectacled professor husband in a smoke-filled living room. Instead, she was crowded with a bunch of grungy 30-somethings in a third-floor walk-up, listening to Fleetwood Mac.
They were different, he said.
Different how?
Different from you, he said. All people are different. White girls, too?
He was different from anyone she'd ever known. His native language was Creole, his English inflected by his accent. He had a nearly photographic memory, so when he helped her run lines, he always learned them before she did. They'd met at 8 Ball, the dive bar where she worked. Somehow, past the burly bikers crowded around high tops, past the tattooed girls feeding the jukebox quarters to play Joan Jett, past her own attempts to blend in, they'd noticed each other. She was still trying to find her first acting gig then, and nobody understood why she'd left Los Angeles to do so, but she liked the stage. In Los Angeles, every actor she knew was obsessed with breaking into Hollywood, because anyone with sense knew that Hollywood was where the money was. But that whole process seemed like a drag. Waking up at dawn, standing in front of a camera for hours, repeating the same lines until some asshole director was satisfied. The stage was something else altogether, new every time, which terrified and thrilled her. Each show was different, each audience unique, each night crackling with possibility. The fact that there was no money in what she was doing was just a bonus. She was only 24 then, still romanced by the idea of her own suffering.
I know that, she told France. That's why I'm asking what they were like.
Soon, she regretted asking when they began to run into his ex-girlfriends around the city. Sage, the poet, who published long, rambling essays about the female body that she still sent to France for notes. Hannah, the engineer, studying how to improve sanitation in poor countries. Kennedy had imagined a frumpy girl wading through sewage, not this perky blonde on the subway, perfectly balanced in her 5-inch boots. Christina played the clarinet for the Brooklyn Philharmonic. At dinner, Kennedy stirred her creamed spinach while Christina and France discussed Brahms. He was right. They were all different. She felt stupid for being surprised. Part of her had imagined that his other white girlfriends were altered versions of herself. Her, if she had, say, grown up in Jersey or decided on a whim to dye her hair red. But his taste in white girls was varied, and she couldn't decide what was worse. To be the latest iteration in a series of similar lovers, or to be radically different from the ones who'd come before her. Belonging to a pattern was safe, at least. To be singular was a risk. What was it exactly that France liked about her? How could she ever hope to keep him interested?
What if I told you, she said, that I'm not white?
She didn't plan to say this. It just came out. France smiled, his beer raised to his lips.
What are you then? He said.
Well, not full white, she said. I'm part black, too.
She'd never said this out loud before. She'd wondered if saying it might make it feel more real, as if something innate would awaken inside her at the sound of those words. But the admission felt phony, like she was reciting lines. She couldn't even convince herself. France squinted at her a moment.
Ah, yes, he said. I see it now.
You do?
Sure, he said. I know plenty of Negroes with hair as kinky as yours.
He was teasing. He thought she was kidding, and over time it became a joke between them. If she was running late, he'd say that she was on colored people time. If she snapped at him, he'd say,
Easy there, sister.
Soon it became a joke to her, too. Jude, her mother's secret, all of it. She would know, she decided. You couldn't go through your whole life not knowing something so fundamental about yourself. She would feel it somehow. She would see it in the faces of other blacks, some sort of connection. But she felt nothing. She glanced at them across the subway car with the vague disinterest of a stranger. Even France was essentially foreign to her. Not because he was black, although that perhaps underscored it. But his life, his language, even his interests were apart from her. Sometimes she stepped inside the little closet he'd converted into an office and watched him scribble equations that she'd never understand. There were many ways to be alienated from someone, few to actually belong. Her mother hated France. She called him uppity.
"And not for the reason you think," she said.
They were sitting in the window of a cafe, watching all the people walk by. Her mother had flown out to visit her during her Thanksgiving break. Kennedy had insisted she couldn't take time away from work and auditions to visit home, but really she just wanted her mother to see her New York life. She took a perverse delight in it, like she was a child dragging her over to see the drawing she'd scribbled on the wall. "Look at the mess I've made." Her mother had tried her best not to react. She'd kept her lips drawn tight during the grand tour of the basement apartment. Nodded quietly as Kennedy took her by eight ball. But France was the last straw, the one part of her unacceptable life that her mother could not ignore.
"And what reason is that?" Kennedy said.
"You know."
There were two black women next to them eating croissants. Her mother would never say it aloud.
"It's not that. I just don't like anybody who acts like him."
"Like what?"
"Like his you-know-what don't stink."
She must have had the only mother in all of Brooklyn who was too polite to say the word shit in public.
"I don't know why you don't like him," Kennedy said. "He was perfectly nice to you."
"I never said he wasn't. But he walks around like he's the smartest person in the room."
"Well, he is. He has a PhD from Dartmouth, for God's sake. I always feel like a dummy around him."
"I just don't understand it. You never liked anyone like him before."
In high school, she dated boys in studded leather jackets who wore their hair long and greasy like the Ramones. Her first boyfriend could barely see without swiping long strands out of his eyes. She thought it was darling, but it drove her father crazy. He imagined her dating, as all fathers do, boys who reminded him of his younger self, hair shorn, sharply dressed, career-focused, not these slouchy boys she'd brought home, always a little baked, shy of total irreverence but near it. She dated boys in bands that played music so terribly she could not have endured listening if not for love. She dated a wrestler in college and watched him run around for hours draped in garbage bags, trying to drop weight. She could never love a man who cared that much about anything, she told herself later. But here she was, living with one who jotted equations on the bathroom mirror before he could forget them.
"Well, it was time for a change," she said.
Her bad boy phase had ended. Her mother should have been relieved, but she only looked troubled.
"It's not because of that girl, is it?" she said.
They hadn't spoken about Jude in 2 years, but she hadn't left them. Kennedy knew right away who her mother meant.
"What are you talking about?" she said.
"Well, you never liked anyone like this before. Then that silly girl got into your head. I just hope you're not trying to prove anything."
She seemed so flustered, fingering the handle of her coffee cup, that Kennedy looked away. If dating France had been some type of experiment, then it had failed terribly. Loving a black man only made her feel whiter than before.
"I'm not," she said. "Come on, let's go to the museum."
The winter she saw Jude Winston again, Kennedy starred in an off-off-Broadway musical